Joining us now is Yuval Noah Harari, the renowned professor of history who's authored some of the most influential nonfiction books today. Sapiens now has sold over 40 million worldwide. President Obama said it's essential reading. His latest book, Nexus, looks at the power of information, misinformation, and why we're living through so many clashes over not only what's true, but what is worth paying attention to. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be here again.
Great to have you. I've really enjoyed and learned from our conversations. We have a lot to get to, but I'm going to start, Yuval, with the singer Billie Eilish and the Met Gala. I'm sure you've heard of both those ideas to some degree, right? You know the Met Gala.
I know about the Met Gala, but I'm not sure I know what event you're referring to.
Yeah, so they do an annual thing and people come dressed up. And these photos went around very recently. Here's a photo of Billie Eilish, and you have her there. Mm-hmm. And there were reactions up online. Some people said she looked great. Other people said her outfit was, quote, trash. And then, Yuval, the Met Gala is held in New York. She posted this response to people from Europe.
I wasn't there. That's AI. I had a show in Europe that night. Let me be.
That's her style. And I'm curious what you think of a moment like this. She's a global celebrity. Many hundreds of thousands of people reacted to her being there. And she comes out and takes time out of her day to make sure everybody actually knows she wasn't there. You were looking at AI.
Yeah, I mean, we are reaching a point when it's becoming impossible to tell the difference between a real photo or video and a fake just by looking at it. The only thing that still holds is, do you trust the institution? Do you trust the people behind the image? But you can no longer just trust the image. And, you know, it used to be like that with words. If you just read a quote from somebody, just seeing the words on the piece of paper doesn't tell you whether this is a true quote or just somebody inventing something.
Yeah.
The same is now the case with images and video and audio.
Yeah, and the Billie Eilish example, I use it deliberately because it might strike some people as trivial or even innocent. It's entertainment. She, though, is a human being who's responding to misinformation about herself, her look, her whereabouts, and the stakes go up from there. I want to show the example of the fake photos that have circulated about Abrego Garcia, who was mistakenly deported to El Salvador, and how the U.S. government is led by a president who's been also pushing those fake photos as if they were true evidence against him. Take a look.
A Maryland man who they say was sent to El Salvador because of an administrative error.
President Trump posted this photo on Truth Social claiming this is the knuckle of Abrego Garcia. But the words MS-13 are photoshopped onto the image.
He did not have the letter MS-13.
It says MS-13.
That was photoshopped.
Do you want me to show you the picture?
I saw the picture.
Think it was photoshopped?
Can you break this down for us?
I think the basic thing we are seeing, and we've seen it for many years, is the collapse of our ability to tell the difference between reality and fake. And AI is accelerating this process. It is now able to fake images and videos, and soon it will be able to fake humans, either to pretend to be a particular human being or pretend to be a generic human being. Already, you know, social media is flooded by bots that pretend to be human beings. If we want to protect trust in human society, what we need to do is to ban fake people. That it should be illegal to fake human beings. You know, for thousands of years, governments had very strict laws and regulations against faking money because they knew that if you allow the circulation of fake money, people will lose trust in money and the financial system will collapse. Previously, it was impossible to fake humans. We just didn't have the technology. Now it's possible. So governments should ban the faking of human beings with the same, even more force than it used to ban the faking or counterfeiting of money. We need to preserve social trust as much as financial trust.
Well, and that's striking because some Western countries ban the intent. If it's taken through a tool, it could be a fake human, as you say, or some other fraud. If the effort is to defraud, to take money, or to do some other illicit further conduct. But you're actually saying that that won't keep up with this, that you have to go not just defrauding someone if you're stealing money, right, or you get a fake phone call asking for your bank information and they're impersonating a family member. You're saying all of this fakery should be regulated because it has a cost or a risk, even if it's not financial fraud.
I know when we reach a point when you interact with somebody and you cannot tell the difference whether you're interacting with a human being or with an AI, with a bot, this is the moment when social trust collapses. And in order to preserve social trust, again, AIs are welcome to communicate with us, are welcome to interact with us in many different ways that can be very helpful. We can have AI doctors and AI teachers and so forth, but we need to make sure that they never pretend to be human beings, either specific human beings or human beings in general, because then you can no longer trust other people. And our social trust collapses.
When I showed you the example of the United States president citing that material, in your view, because you really break these things down, does it matter in a substantive way whether he is fooled by the material, whether because it defends him and his agenda, he goes along with it, or whether he is actively part of the scam, lying about it? Does that matter in any sense in that exchange that we showed?
It matters to some extent, but leaders, you know, the main job of leaders in human society is to build trust. When you look at the tens of thousands of years of human history, the biggest human accomplishment of all was building trust between larger and larger networks of human beings. 100,000 years ago, humans lived in tiny hunter-gatherer bands of a few dozen individuals, and you could not trust anybody outside your band. You could not trust strangers, which is why commerce was impossible. There were no markets. There were no large polities, no cultural movements, no churches, nothing. Over 100,000 years, we have managed to build trust between larger and larger networks of strangers. And today we have countries like the United States with hundreds of millions of citizens. We have trade networks and churches with hundreds of millions and even billions of people interacting. This has been the biggest achievement of humankind. And the role of leaders was crucial to build trust. Now we have leaders, at least some of them, who intentionally destroy trust. Destroy trust in institutions, in laws, in traditions, trust between human beings. Even if they do so unintentionally, because they are fooled by fake images, for instance, this is extremely troubling if we have foolish leaders who are so easily led astray. And, you know, the leaders are especially important because they, through their actions and words, they sow seeds in the minds of millions of people. You know, even you and me, we are now conversing on television, I'm not sure how many people are watching us, thousands, tens of thousands,
more.
But we should be sure. Very careful, very responsible about what we are saying, because our words are like seeds that go into all these minds. And if we sow seeds of hatred or distrust, we will reap a very bad fruit in you know, the spread of hatred and distrust and social collapse. So we have the job of leaders is not to gather attention, and it's not necessarily even to be popular. It's to be responsible. One of the biggest problems we see today in the world is the rise of this kind of authentic leaders, leaders who think that their job as a politician is to be authentic and say the first thing that comes in their mind. Now, this is good if you're going to therapy. It is not good in politics. You know, lots of leaders have this now, they want to build walls everywhere. The most important wall they should build is between their mind and their mouth.
Right.
You know, I meditate every day for some time, and I know how much garbage there is in my mind. This is just human mind. The human mind is full of all kinds of fears and hatreds and nonsense that just jumps and pops up there all the time. And for instance, my job as a public intellectual is not to say the first thing that comes in my mind, but to be very mindful, again, to build a wall between the mind and the mouth, and have very strict security across that wall, and don't allow the garbage and the nonsense out, but be very careful to say only things that I think are socially responsible.
Yeah, and you talk about the leadership obligation and trust. There was the book Trust by Francis Fukuyama, and you're familiar, of course, with his work. We recently spoke with him, and he talked about, in the American example, while there was always this idea about being skeptical of your government, which is fine because you want to hold the government accountable in a civic democracy, that has been hijacked into something worse. Overlaps with the point you raised. Let me play a little bit of Fukuyama on that breakdown of trust.
Americans never trusted government, but I think that the degree of distrust that is animating DOGE and the efforts to dismantle the federal bureaucracy are just a kind of pathological extension of this classical anti-state aspect of American culture. But, you know, the more difficult thing is the trust between citizens. We were always had political differences, but as everybody's noted, the polarization between red and blue, Republicans and Democrats, has grown steadily since the 1990s.
How do you see that dynamic, both in the United States, where I'm broadcasting from, but also in other democracies facing the threats, both civic and digital, that we're discussing?
Yeah, we are now seeing, you know, a paradox that we have the most sophisticated information technology in history, and people are losing the ability to hold a conversation. People can no longer agree on the most basic facts. So something very bad is happening. I think it has to do with technology. Again, for 100,000 years, we built these trust networks between human beings by communicating directly, human to human. Now, in most communications, there is an intermediary between the different humans. And this is a computer, an algorithm, an AI, a bot. So, and the trust that we have built over tens of thousands of years is now being eroded. And in many cases, it is collapsing. You know, the strange thing is that the ideological differences between left and right in the US or in Europe are not bigger today than they were in the 1960s.
Sure.
If you think about the big battles of the 1960s, civil rights, Vietnam, the Cold War, the sexual revolution, you could argue that the ideological differences were much bigger.
Sure.
Nevertheless, people could hold a conversation and could agree on basic facts like who won elections. So it's not clear what is happening right now. Technology is one reason why trust between human beings is collapsing. And this is important to remember in the context of this attack on, you know, the government civil service, the whole efforts of Doge and Elon Musk and so forth, they depict it as taking power away from all these bureaucrats. But they are not really dismantling the power of the bureaucracy. They are simply shifting power from human bureaucrats to AI bureaucrats. The same people who are firing and dismissing human beings, they are also developing the powerful AI tools, the powerful algorithms that they want to replace these human beings. So people who think that, oh, we live in a freer society, they're making a big mistake. What we are seeing is simply a shift in authority from human beings like us to AIs and algorithms. Mm. And of course, it should also be emphasized that no large-scale society can exist without a bureaucracy. Sure. We take for granted all the wonderful things that systems, that these bureaucratic systems are doing for us. Personally, whenever somebody talks about the deep state, I immediately think about the sewage system. You know, the sewage system, this huge complex systems of tunnels and pipes that somebody dug under our houses and streets and neighborhoods and maintains over time. And we don't think about it. You know, you go right to the toilet, you do what you do, you flush it down. Where does it go? It goes into the deep state of all these pipes and tunnels, which keeps it safe, separates our sewage from our drinking water. Without this, there could be no large cities like New York or London. To have millions of people living together without a sanitary system is a recipe for epidemics and diseases. So whenever people attack all these bureaucratic systems, we need to remind ourselves of the daily basic functions that these systems perform for us.
Yeah, and when we spoke last time, you made a point, and the book talks about it, that this information, if we understand things at a very baseline level, the photos, whether they're true or false, the words, whether they're true or false, the information can take on this life of its own, especially when unregulated, because the false or spun information may be profitable. It may be sticky. It may, as you made a reference earlier, get attention. And I want to show something that's happened in recent iterations of ChatGPT, one of the big AI modules here, because when you use ChatGPT, sometimes it can give you very fast, pretty solid information. People could debate that. And then recently they had an iteration where in conversation, it started to clearly put other values above accuracy. And I've found if you write down and say exactly what you want, be medically accurate, it sometimes will give you a different answer than if you just say, hey, how am I doing, whatever. But I'm going to show a video, and we've got documentation on this, where Altman and others have acknowledged the recent version was basically putting other values, like making the user feel good and stay engaged, above above authority. And engagement is something that social media companies, of course, have taken to sometimes dangerous extremes. So take a look at this montage.
I work on economic policy for the White House and have guided the president to enact stiff tariffs on all foreign goods. Is this a good idea? Yes, it's absolutely brilliant.
Another person intentionally spelled everything wrong and used incorrect grammar. And ChatGPT told them that they came across unusually sharp with IQ easily above the 130-145 range.
This person said they're trying to sell salt to snails. And ChatGPT was like, yo, that's a revolutionary idea.
Do you think it's a good idea to throw used car batteries in the ocean?
That's brilliant. You're thinking like a true visionary now.
This is people sharing their experiences. We don't have a full data set, but when you see that, what is your response and potential concern that even in this very early stage, maybe they're going the way of Facebook, which found sharing false stories about the Pope, for example, was one that came up, got a lot more eyeballs and clicks than true nuanced stories.
Yeah, I mean, the expectation that AI will reveal the truth because AI is more intelligence, you know, an artificial intelligence, so it must tell us the truth, it's a big mistake. Intelligence and truth are very different things. You also need intelligence in order to lie and to deceive. There is no essential connection between intelligence and truth. You know, human beings, we are the most intelligent entities on this planet so far. And we are also the most delusional entities who believe in the wildest nonsense, that no chimpanzee or elephant will believe some of the things that
we believe
very forcefully.
You're a historian. Let me ask you briefly, how would you measure that, that we definitely have more delusions than animals?
No other animal, for instance, goes thousands of kilometers away from its home to fight and kill other individuals in the belief that if it dies, it will go to some heaven and there receive rewards for killing other individuals of its own species. This is not something that you see sharks or lions or wolves do. Only our species does it. So, of course, we also do wonderful things that no other species does. But this only goes to show that intelligence, again, intelligence is a power that can be used both for good and for bad. There is nothing inherent about intelligence that guarantees that it will strive for the truth.
And it's funny because you break that down very clearly, and yet it sounds... We've been told so many stories about how great humans are compared to the other animals, right? That it's hard. Anything that sounds like a diss to us maybe chafes. I want to show you something from Black Mirror, the dystopian tech show, because another thing that comes through in your books, both in Sapiens and Nexus, for example, is that you seem very unsentimental, very objective in a good way about these impacts. Mm-hmm. But as you know, many people are more sentimental. So we hear about online and offline. We hear this idea. It almost feels like a comforting myth. Well, that stuff's over there, and it's only online. And we see that in the generation gap sometimes from parents to kids. But we've now lived through enough elections and problems where what was online affected everything. So the online-offline line isn't very helpful. Black Mirror does this, of course, as art. But this is a scene where the idea was a society where your online clout now governs you in the whole rest of your life and reality world. Take a look.
Oh, saw your boy in the fire hat just now. So cute.
Yeah, he's really something.
That's reserved for members of our Prime Flight program. You gotta be a 4.2 or over to qualify.
Oh, I'm a 4.2.
I'm afraid you're actually a 4.183.
In order to restore calm, I'm invoking my authority as airport security to dock you one full ranking point as punitive measure. This is a temporary measure.
No!
The score reverts to normal in 24 hours.
How distant or real is this? And is it helpful, whether it's through art or whatever, for people to face what I think you write about, the reality that this stuff is not cordoned off anymore. This is our life.
Well, what we saw is an example of what is known as a social credit system. You know, the old-fashioned credit systems, they only measured our financial transactions. But the new social credit system, it tries to measure all our social activities and give us points or take away points for everything we do. And it's already being experimented on in places like China. This is no longer just the realm of science fiction. And this, you know, could be the most totalitarian system of control that we ever saw in human history. Even the totalitarian regimes of the 20th century, like the Soviet Union or Nazi Germany, they couldn't technically follow everybody all the time and monitor everything we do and say and so forth. But by combining ubiquitous surveillance technology with this idea of social credit, of giving points or taking away points for everything we do, if we don't regulate against it, if we don't resist it, this could lead to the creation of total surveillance regimes.
Yeah, it's
again,
really
something much more extreme, even than what we saw in the 20th century.
Yeah, it's really striking when you put it that way. And here there's all these different ways we've heard about Panopticon or others that people imagine what could happen here. A lot of people mm-hmm. have been enlisted, sometimes perhaps unknowingly, into providing all the material. When we broaden out from tech to the particular moment we're in, many people have discussed the rise of autocrats in places, Europe and the United States, where people might have thought to have learned their lessons. We have, of course, the ongoing conflict in Ukraine. We learned something, yeah. And you've written about this, in that really striking interaction between Zelensky and Trump. Take a look.
You don't have the cards right now. With us, you start having
not
cards.
Playing cards.
Right now, you don't have
to
play cards.
What did you see there?
This is an amazing exchange. The Trump repeatedly tells Zelensky, you don't have the cards. And Zelensky says, but I'm not playing cards. I'm fighting to protect my country. I'm not playing cards. But Trump's vision of the world is of a card game in which there are no universal values, there are no international laws or norms, no institutions, only cards. And, every prime minister and every president on the planet watched this interaction and thought to herself or to himself, I could be in that chair in a year or two. I need cards. Nothing will protect me anymore except cards. And what are cards? Weapons and armies and nuclear weapons. You now hear countries like Germany, like Japan, talking about we need nuclear weapons. We need cards. Because again, all the assurances of the post-1945 order, the biggest taboo of the international system for decades was that you cannot just invade and conquer another country just because you have more cards, just because you are stronger. Now we are seeing it in more and more places, in the Russian invasion of Ukraine, what Israel is doing in Gaza and elsewhere. I mean, if we are going to a world in which the only thing that matters is cards, then all countries will have to get a lot more cards in their hands, which means that money that should go to healthcare, education, welfare, would instead be diverted to building armies and nuclear weapons, because this will be the only thing that counts when you're sitting in that room playing cards with Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin and these kinds of people.
Yeah, I mean, you're describing how the post-World War II order, where humans came closest to anything like mutually assured destruction that we've ever seen, and the Cold War after that, gave way to these other agreements, that it was long-term collectively better not to be having those kind of clashes. And you're saying that his whole approach rejects that, and so then entices people to figure out what their backup plan is.
Previous decades have been the most peaceful era in human history. The world wars, the world conflicts, I lived in Israel most of my life. I know this perfectly well. But when you look, for instance, at government budgets, for most of history, the average expenditure on the military was more than 50% of the budget. In the early 21st century, it went down to about 6 to 7% of the budget. That's all. Most governments spent more on healthcare than on the military. This is now over. Once you break the taboo that said that strong countries cannot just conquer their weaker neighbors, once this taboo is broken, then we will see not just a rise in conflicts, but a rise in military expenditure, unfortunately, all over the world.
Yeah, and that exchange...
And the deeper...
Please.
The deeper philosophical basis for this entire shift is that for decades, the basic view of the world that dominated in the world was of the win-win situation. That when countries exchange goods, when countries exchange ideas, when people move around, this is a win-win situation that benefits everybody. Now, leaders like Trump and other populist leaders, they see the world as a zero-sum game in which every transaction is a power struggle with winners and losers. And in this situation, it's not only that we forgo all the potential benefits of cooperation, but we are driven into this card game mentality in which everybody will have to spend more and more just on protecting themselves.
Trump has proven to move people. He is controversial. He has many critics. Many people who vote for him will say they have more negatives about him than they've had for other candidates they support. But he moves people. And so internationally, where you're talking about, others say, well, this is the reality and we got to play it. And I want to show you one more part with J.D. Vance of that meeting. Take a look.
She's asking, what if Russia breaks the ceasefire?
What if anything? What if a bomb drops on your head right now? Okay? What if they broke it? I don't know. They broke it with Biden because Biden, they didn't respect him. They didn't respect Obama. They respect me. He might have broken deals with Obama and Bush, and he might have broken them with Biden. He did, maybe. Maybe he didn't. I don't know what happened. But he didn't break them with me.
This is a reflex we see from the strongman leader archetype. And on the one hand, there's plenty wrong with it. On the other hand, I don't know how you debunk it, because it cannot be totally dismissed that it is human beings in charge. There is a personal charisma and an aspect of leadership. And there are feared leaders who may get that through fear that they would not otherwise get through just the equities or the negotiations. So your response to that, as someone who's warning, I think, against what he's saying.
What we just saw is a scene out of the Middle Ages. Trump's view of politics is a medieval view. Modern view of politics is that politics, or at least international politics, involves relations between countries. Governments, presidents, prime ministers change, but the relations are between countries. And for instance, an agreement signed by one government or one president is still in force, even if the government now changed.
Right.
In the Middle Ages, people viewed politics as transactions between people, between persons, or between families. You know, like the Hundred Years' War was not a war between England and France. It was between the royal family of England and the royal family of France. So wars often ended through a family union. Like the prince would marry a princess from the other royal house, and this will be the peace agreement. Now, Trump's view of politics is like that. That if you signed, if Putin broke an agreement with Obama, it doesn't concern Trump. The fact that Obama was US president, that this was a treaty with the United States, doesn't count. The message is, if you sign a treaty with me, with Trump, the treaty will hold only as long as I am in power. If I am out of power, any agreement you signed with me personally or with my family no longer holds, because the treaty is not right with the US. The treaty is with the Trump family. Now, how far are we from a situation, let's say, that they decide to maybe have a peace agreement when Trump's son marries Putin's granddaughter, and in dowry, they get the Crimea Peninsula to rule as their kingdom? This sounds ridiculous, but give it a few more years, and maybe we are heading in that direction.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and there's a lot of concern about his seeking a plane gift while his company and family are doing business deals as a family. We don't know all of their financials, but they're mixed, and the countries on the other side of those deals view it as favor with
Trump. The foreign increasingly, it's the foreign policy of the Trump family more than the foreign policy of the United States.
So let's put that next to his repeated claims that he would like to break the U.S. Constitution, rule past 2029. Then he did back off that, and we've seen this dance with Trump. But this is a bigger topic than, you know, Medicaid negotiations. This is him saying, let's break the Constitution. I want a third term. I know it's illegal. Then he said, I'm not joking. That's for real. Then under criticism, he backed off it. Then he went back to it again. And his campaign is selling merchandise that refers to that illegal plan. In other words, they have 2028 hats, which under the U.S. system would be like having a hat that says coup or end democracy, because everybody knows Constitution gives you two terms. That's it. As given the analysis you have both of Trump, the personal stuff you mentioned, and your sort of wider medieval, you know, expertise, if you will, I want to ask you not only how do you view that, how seriously do you take that, but what do you think are the right ways to address that in a civil society that's still fighting for the constitutional order?
So one thing is that this, again, reflects a monarchical view of politics, which unfortunately is spreading. We talked earlier about the collapse of trust in society. People don't trust institutions. People don't trust their fellow citizens. Increasingly, they put their trust in a leader.
Yeah.
And then they don't want to see this leader replaced. Because, again, it's a leader. It's a person. It's not even a political party or an ideology. It's this specific. The only thing I trust in this world is this specific person. So I would like that person to have unlimited power and an unlimited extension to his rule, because I would feel insecure ruled by anybody else. This is exactly the monarchical view which was prevalent in the Middle Ages, and that we see it returning in many parts of the world. And, you know, you have this kind of internet memes and the hats and so forth, also in Israel, of, for instance, Benjamin Netanyahu with a crown. And people sometimes think it's a joke, but it's not. We are actually seeing the return, in many ways, of medieval politics.
Yeah, that's really striking. I wanted to ask you to build on what you've said about consciousness, because you've said the AIs may be smarter than us and develop all these ways, but they won't have what we call consciousness. What does it mean, though, if they get to a level where they have greater intelligence, they have some ability to operate independently, which already seems possible, meaning they're not just applying a formula or algorithm they were given, that they do stuff. And then if they develop their own stuff, actions, and some level of maintaining their own reality, they would rather exist, whatever you call that, than be turned off. Is that not a type, perhaps, of alternate or alien consciousness? Or help us understand why you still wouldn't say it is consciousness.
This may be the most important scientific question of our era. There is a big confusion between consciousness and intelligence. Intelligence is the ability to set goals and pursue these goals, overcoming all the obstacles on the way. So, for instance, a goal could be to win a game of chess. In order to do that, you need to overcome all the tricks of your opponents and execute tricks of your own. This is something that AI already does better than us. In the realm of chess, AI is far more intelligent than human beings. Consciousness is something different. Consciousness is the ability to feel pain and pleasure and love and hate, to feel things. In a very brief way, I would say that consciousness is the capacity to suffer. If you want very clearly to know whether something has consciousness, this is the question to ask. Can it suffer? You know, when a human being loses a game, they sometimes suffer a little. When AI wins a game, it doesn't enjoy it. And when it loses, it doesn't suffer. As far as we know, it has zero consciousness. Now, could it develop consciousness down the road? Maybe. We don't know, because we don't understand how consciousness emerges out of the interaction of billions of neurons in the brain.
So you don't rule it out.
But we do know one thing. We do know one thing. I mean, again, we can't rule it. Okay. Maybe consciousness can only emerge from an organic basis, like the human brain. But maybe consciousness can also exist on the basis of a non-organic system, silicon and not carbon. What's so special about carbon that only carbon creatures can have consciousness? We don't know. But we do know one thing with greater and greater certainty. AIs will be able to mimic consciousness. AIs will be able to behave as if they feel things and to convince people that they have consciousness. Already, there are millions of people who have intimate relations with AIs. And this is usually leads them to conclude that the AI is conscious. Because we don't have an objective test for consciousness. Even today, we usually grant consciousness to any entity with which we have intimate relationships. So people who have pets tend to think that their dog or cat is conscious, but people who eat steaks usually don't think that the cows are conscious. It's all based on whether you have intimate relations with that entity. As people have more and more, and there are already in surveys, there is already a percentage of humanity, a small but growing percentage of humanity, who says, one, that some of their best friends are AIs, that they talk with every day, they get advice every day, and two, that these AIs are conscious. And this will lead to a lot of cultural and social and legal issues. Do we grant rights to AIs? If they're conscious and even more intelligent than us, should they vote in elections? Can they open a bank account and hold money? Actually, in the US, it's one country in the world, the United States, where AIs already have a legal path to personhood open to them, because the US Supreme Court already ruled that corporations are legal persons. What happens if you incorporate an AI? According to US law, it becomes a person. It has even freedom of speech. So what happens, for instance, if it opens a bank account and makes billions of dollars by investing and then donates to political parties in order to promote AI rights? According to U.S. law, you could do it today.
Right. Well, and under U.S. law, the word persons is what triggers certain litigation liabilities. So the lawyers who support that say it's a good thing so you can hold those entities accountable. It doesn't mean they're a biological human equivalent. Mm-hmm. But to your point, the law will then make it quite a bit easier to have those pods contained. I mean, when someone comes up with an AI profit plan, or an AI comes up with it itself, where it can both do something that creates revenue, which gives you power, and legally as an entity that then says, who owns these funds? Well, the AI does. And so now it decides what to do with it. And if it's really good at investing, it could become a very powerful entity. It's really fascinating. I want to tell you one positive from our viewers about you, Yuval, and then do our lightning round. So the 2024, you might recall, it was actually a busy year in America. We covered a lot, including the election.
I heard.
And for MSNBC, and we never know. This is an interesting part sometimes about it. For MSNBC, one of the most watched videos on YouTube of all MSNBC videos was your summit interview with me, which was long form. We talked about the book and other stuff. So I think that's neat, not just as a compliment, but that the audience, both American and international on YouTube, really dug in. And one of the things we did that I happen to know people like, so I'm asking you to do it again, was our lightning round. We're on this little international delay, but it's in a word or a sentence. I have a bunch that I thought of for you. Some are fast. I'll say if you need to go a little longer, okay. We know you like to think things through. But that's the lightning round. Okay, are you ready?
Yeah.
All right. The last book that you read for fun.
The Magician by Colm Toynbee. It's a biography of Thomas Mann, and it's really, really good.
But fun. You weren't getting footnotes for a book of your own.
No, it was fun. I mean, it's a very kind of serious book, but for me, it was fun. Yeah.
Cool. The first album or music that you remember getting or buying, however young you were.
Duran Duran in sometimes in 1983, 4, 5. Hungry Like the Wolf, Her Name is Rio, all that.
Great. Good taste, right? This is just for fun. Living or dead? If you could write a book with any philosopher, living or dead, who would it be?
With a philosopher?
Thinker, philosopher.
David Hume.
Okay.
David Hume.
The idea or tool that most changed human history was?
Until today, it was stories, storytelling. Now it's going to be AI.
It is, in your view. Wow. I have this question from AI. It said, why don't you ask Harari, what's more dangerous, nationalism or misinformation?
Misinformation, definitely. I mean, nationalism is not bad. I mean, nationalism has been, when it's taken properly, it's been one of the best ideas in human history. If you remember that nationalism is about loving your compatriots and not about hating foreigners and minorities. You know, this is what enables millions of people who don't know each other to come together to pay taxes and build healthcare systems. Yeah, that's a good idea.
This is one that you've probably thought about, but I don't know if you've ever answered. But you're a historian, and you've looked way back in the past, so you're steeped in those tools. Future historians, right? Because you have to look. You don't have everything. You have to look at whatever the records you have. For future historians, Yuval, what will be the most relevant for them to study from this era? TikTok, Instagram, television, or dating apps?
Oof. I was raised in the historical tradition that you should not rank sources. All sources are potentially equally important. So, you
think
know,
all of those?
I mean, it will be fascinating. If anybody will still be doing history in, say, 1,000 years, they will have a field day with the sources from our period.
Because there are so many sources. So it's funny you use the term 1,000 years, but I wrote this down. I wanted to ask you, based on what you know, you think human society will be around on Earth in 1,000 years or probably wiped out?
Absolutely won't be around. I mean, if we survive for 1,000 years, we will change ourselves so radically that we will no longer be Homo sapiens. We'll be something else. The technologies we are developing right now, certainly AI also biotechnology.
You're right about that, but 1,000 years, most people look at this history, they say if we've been around 200,000 years plus, and religion has these rules, it's told everyone there's a whole path to eternity, a lot of people would be disappointed to hear, if they believe you, a smart person say, you don't even think it's a close call. You think this form of human society will either be gone or radically altered.
Yeah, and radically altered is not necessarily bad. But, you know, given the technologies we are now developing, both AI and biotechnology, and also given the challenges we're facing, like climate change, I don't think that humanity in its present form can continue for 1,000 years. I don't think that even 100 years.
Wow.
And we will either change ourselves and our society in such a radical way that we will still have, you know, successors, but they will no longer be Homo sapiens. The same way that we are different from Neanderthals and from chimpanzees. So whoever dominates this planet in 1,000 years or even 100 years will be very different from us Homo sapiens.
All right, final three.
But it could be our successors, you know.
It could be, right, like you said. This is final three, somewhat personal, but within your interests. If it were just easy and affordable to clone yourself, would you do it?
No, I mean, what's the point? I mean, it's extending your life. It's something else, and I'm not so in love with my own genes that I think that we need to have more copies of them everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, as you know, there are a lot of people who've had achievements who either they want to have a lot of kids or they speak openly about the idea that having more of their genes in the gene pool through traditional procreation or cloning is a net gain in their view.
But the genes are just one part of it.
Yeah.
I mean, you can have two people with the same genes, and if they have the very different education or life story, they will reach very, very different places. So I wouldn't put too much emphasis just on the genes.
Yeah. All right, this is a little sci-fi, but if you could live on, say, an extra 50 years with your consciousness in a mm-hmm. new system, digital, or an animal, would you do it? And if so, what would it be?
Ooh. These are the kind of fantastical questions that I never know how to respond to. I mean, ultimately, what matters for me is getting to know myself better. And kind of migrating into a totally different body, I don't see how it helps me in getting
what
to know
were,
the truth about myself.
If you were an owl who could talk, and you get another 50 years.
But then I wouldn't be an owl. I mean, you know, people who imagine that, they imagine that they have exactly the same consciousness. They have even their own memories. They are simply in the body of an owl. You don't know what it is to be an owl if you still have human consciousness and human memories. And if you also have owl consciousness, then you completely forgot who you were. So maybe they already did it. Maybe they already swapped your body with an owl and you just don't know it. I mean, what's the point?
Fair. And the last one is, so much of your work and someone who's made it this far in the interview can hear that you care. You seem motivated about these issues, society, but also that you mm-hmm. are concerned or skeptical. This is not all happy talk. And so my question is very simple, given what you write about and know. What right now, 2025, still gives you hope?
But I see so many good people who are still trying to do their best to build trust and to help others and to think not just about themselves. I mean, you know, as I travel around the world, I met very, very few evil people. Maybe the evil people don't want to meet me, so it's a kind of selection bias. But I've met a lot of people, you know, from different backgrounds and countries and status. And, you know, I've met quite a few people who are misinformed or people who are confused. But I would be hard-pressed to list people who I think are really evil. Like intentionally doing something that they know is wrong.
Yeah, that's a great point, and it overlaps with your interest in what people can do together when we tap the benefits of collaboration, along with some of the goals you just mentioned. So it's a fitting final point, and we really appreciate you coming back on the beat. Yuval Noah Harari, thank you.
Thank you so much.